Look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes a secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. A world dismissed as conspiracy by those who want to keep its secrets hidden. Exposing the dangers, denials, and deceptions. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.
Welcome back to this hour of the Hagman and Hagman Report, this segment. We're pleased to be joined by our man, Stan Dale from standale.com. Before we get to our guests, I want to just a couple of real quick announcements. Folks, you asked for it. We're giving it to you. Actually, we're not giving it to you. The music of Joe Charles, available to you coming soon, coming next week, I believe, or very soon. Watch the website for information. What a talented man, musician. His CD coming out, New Jerusalem CD. That's the music of Joe Charles. We get so many emails saying, who's playing the guitar? Who does the intros and such? And well, that's the talent of just a dynamic man who I had a chance to spend some time with in Texas, Joe Charles. And he's just it's going to be fantastic. So watch for that CD to be made available here soon. The music of Joe Charles. And once you listen to it, it's fantastic. So want to just make mention of that. And the only other announcement I have is, again, folks, if you're interested, I do have a limited number of copies of my book, Stand by Blood. I'd be more than happy to sign them and send them out to you at, just go to standbyblood.com. You see the offer, you'll see the offer on the upper right hand side of the website, standbyblood.com. And I have a limited number, but I still have some left. So go ahead and just, if you want one, I'll send one out to you right away. And otherwise, it's available on Amazon.com. So thank you for that.
With that, each and every Tuesday in our third hour, we are joined by Stan Dale from standale.com, and he is with us tonight. And we're going to talk about a number of things, from Noah's Flood, all the way, I'm looking on a show images page here. You can find it at standale.com. On the right-hand side of the page next to the microphone, there's a little link that says show images. You click on that, and it'll pull up all the images that Stan has prepared and put together, talking points and images to go with those talking
points.
Cool
images, man.
Yeah, they are. I was just looking at the which cities in the Mediterranean region were built on seven hills, which you open up and it expands to a number of other areas to look at. Stan, welcome back to the Hagman and Hagman Report.
Thank you, guys. Good to be here. Good to see all of us together again after one whole week has passed and our show is still functioning and, you know, we're alive and not in prison. That's great.
Well, Eric the Tech is missing. We do suspect he was taken away. He might be in prison, given his disposition. I don't know. We're checking on that now. But otherwise, we're okay.
I don't believe that for a second.
Good for you, Stan.
You don't know Eric.
Well, there you go. All right, I guess I don't. But he's awful cheerful when we talk on the phone and stand by, says he.
He's a great guy.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, look, there are a number of little minor things that have been of interest. Over the last few weeks, did you guys see the video that was up on YouTube, it was really quite popular, about the ice river that was discovered in the Saudi Arabian desert?
No.
Yeah.
No.
It's a home video taken on a phone by a Saudi, I guess, or yeah, it was a Saudi. It was there in the what they call the empty quarter, the Rub al Khali, and it's in the daytime. It's not cloudy, and there is this river of snow, like hail and water, a slush of that and sand, flowing past his feet. You know, like that, just really coming past. And he reaches down, he grabs a handful of hail and ice, you know, little particles of ice like snow, out of that passing river. And it goes for miles. Now, I think, I went to discover where they filmed this. It's in about the middle of the Arabian Peninsula, and there's kind of a V formation that comes in from the left side of your screen if you're on, you know, north arrangement, north pole at the top. And there's a number of channels that come from those mountains there that, you know, feed down into the desert and then eventually down into the Persian Gulf. So all I can think of is that this was a result of a sudden, very, very cold rain over the mountains there, which, you know, produced ice and, you know, hail and stuff in such a quantity that it formed this river down to the Persian Gulf full of hailstones. Maybe it's happened before, but it was unusual enough that they filmed it, and people have been kind of debating about what caused it. And so I was reading, you know, watching that video, and then I did some searches on the internet about, you know, rivers in Saudi Arabia and stuff, and see what would come up. And there's an ancient legend I found about this missing mystery river in the Empty Quarter. Now, the Empty Quarter is about the one-fourth of the Arabian Peninsula. It's down there where Yemen's on one side and Oman's on the other side, and it faces into the Indian Ocean. It's that part of the Arabian Peninsula. And if you look on the Google Earth and other maps, it's just sand, you know, reddish sand covering the whole area. And in some places, 200 or 300 feet deep, you know, perhaps even deeper. So there's not really much there as far as cities or any of that kind of stuff. So in that area, it's, you know, the mystery zone. And the local Bedouins and stuff have often said, you know, through the generations, that there's this mystery river. And it's lost, but it is there, and it used to empty directly into the Persian Gulf. Well, certainly we can see evidence of that now. But these same rumors were associated with what they called, get this, the Atlantis of the desert, or they called it the Atlantis of the sands. And so to them, there's a lost city hidden in the sands under all that sand there in the Rub al Khali, which, strangely enough, agrees with what I've been finding in the search for Atlantis, you know, the capital city. I've got Atlantis, the continent all, you know, the island all figured out, and I'm making maps and videos for the lecture. But I thought this was really interesting that they, you know, thought that there was an ancient lost city of the sands. I think, what was his name? Of the desert, something of the desert, made a movie about it.
Lawrence of Arabia?
Yeah, T.H. Lawrence, okay, Lawrence of Arabia. He wrote about that. He was the first one to call it the Lost City of the Sands, the Atlantis of the Sands. And that was in the 1930s, I believe, and since that time the name is stuck in the area. But it's they're trying to find this city. Archaeologists are poking around trying to find it. And I'm hoping I get my lecture and information out before they do, because they're going to find, if they do find the city, that it was, you know, an advanced technology, an advanced civilization, which would underlie the working theory I have on Atlantis there. But anyway, that's just that little side note on that issue. I have been working diligently without chasing rivers of ice and stuff in the desert. I have been working on the flood, the problems with the flood, the problems with who Cain married in the land on the east and the land of Nod and stuff. And I saw it on your chat channel, some of the people there were saying, you know, what happened, who did Cain marry? And there are a few questions there I'm going to address here now. And let's go to the who did Cain marry type thing. There is a growing weight of evidence that more people than Noah and his sons survived the flood. And this is an issue that is very contentious in the Christian community. I realize that, but I'm trying to keep an open mind when I look for support of the Bible and you know, the Christian and Jewish faith. Now, one of the things that crosses rabbis' eyes, and I've studied with a couple of rabbis who were scientific rabbis, they weren't lightweight, they were teaching rabbis, and they say that not only them, but other rabbis before them, great rabbis, have crossed their eyes, literally, over the issue of how did the giants, who were obviously a byproduct of the fallen ones and earth women, how did they get on the other side of the flood if they were all killed out? So in essence, I've been trying to figure out an answer to that myself, because it is rather difficult. I mean, the rabbis have gone to such extremes to try to justify how Og, the king of Bashan, who was an 18-foot giant or whatever, how did he survive the flood. They've looked in Hebrew at the name of Noah, Noah's Ark and stuff, and they derived from that a story that said that Noah fed the king of Bashan, Og, the giant, who held onto the top of his ark for a whole year, of course, and Noah fed him, you know, through the holes in the top of the windows in the top of the ark, and that's how the king of Bashan survived to go over and be, you know, in Bashan after the flood. But this doesn't address the obvious question about the other tribes of giants, you know, like for Goliath and his four brothers and stuff, you know, the Rephaim and Zamzumin, you know, they didn't all hold on to the ark, so there's a problem. And I find the problem is a very simple one. In the Genesis account of the flood, they use a word that has variable meanings. You know, it can mean a country, it can mean a land, it can mean the total globe. And it's called Eretz, Ha-Eretz, the land, the country, or the earth. And when they used that, they were writing it. Who wrote the Genesis account was over in the Sumerian region. We find that that the book of Genesis has at least two authors. You can tell by the way they stated things. And much of the early part of Genesis is written in 65-line stanzas that were normally the length of a Babylonian clay tablet. A book, you know, a small book type thing, and they would repeat the last line of one clay tablet and repeat it as the first line of the next clay tablet. Instead of numbering the pages, they had catch lines, last line, first line type thing, so that you would pick it up and read the next page, know where you were in the last page. Well, okay, having said all that, that area where those records are stored were library records that the pharaohs of Egypt had access to as well. And where did Moses get his knowledge of the ancient world? He was raised in the court of Pharaoh in Egypt, and he had access to all of the libraries and ancient information there. So I'm pretty sure that's where he derived the initial knowledge he had for the book of Genesis, the early part of it particularly, because, you know, nobody dropped a book out to him on Sinai and said, here's Genesis. He wrote that during his 40 years in the desert with the other four books of the Torah. So expanding that, we think, those of us that are studying the appearances of fallen ones or hybrid fallen and human babies or people, we think that a few of the nasties survived the flood that submerged all of the Arabian Peninsula, the Persian Gulf, parts of the Mediterranean. It was a localized regional flood that covered mountains in that area, and certainly I can show that. But that was the area talked about, and not the whole earth. And even though the Hopi Indians talk about their legend saying that the flood came over them in the Rio Grande Valley and they were saved by being put in a cave by the Spider Woman, and there's a little hole up underneath the ocean level, even though that is in their lore as well and in the Chinese lore as well about the people with, you know, the boat with eight people on board, there was Noah and his sons and their wives. Even though those things are there, there is growing evidence that there were small amounts of survivors. If not, then Satan immediately started crossbreeding after the flood again. So that's a possibility. Anyway, those things are of issue, and when you study the Bible dispassionately and try to look for the truth of it, you have to consider these things, especially translational errors. And that's how I found the Garden of Eden back in 2014, was going to the old versions, the old translation meaning of words into the ancient Hebrew, flood was caused by something catastrophic. And this week, yesterday, in fact, Monday, I found what caused the great flood. And it's been a bone of contention for scholars of the Bible for years and years, if not centuries. What caused the great flood? What was the detail of it? We know that the good Lord orchestrated, but how did he do it? And in the show images page on my website today, I have put six photos of the discovery I made. And this is really, it should be secular news. It should be worldwide news, what I found. It was a crater. It was a meteor that formed a crater. This meteor was such a huge meteor. It was the biggest one known on record, and they haven't discovered its impact crater yet until yesterday when I discovered it. There have been people poking around in the area where I found it, saying, well, there's signs that this could be a meteor crater. This thing is, the crater, is 300 miles in diameter. To put it into perspective, the Chicxulub meteor impact crater in the Yucatan Peninsula, that is only 106 miles in diameter, and some reports want to say it's 186, but it matters not. On the first show images page at the top right there, I've got a couple of photos next to each other. One in yellow circle showing the size of Chicxulub, and one in red showing the size of this crater I discovered in eastern India, the Kudapa crater, C-U-D-D-A-P-A-H. They're NIST, in the last probably 10 years, they've been starting to think this might be the top of a large crater, but they aren't sure. So they don't even list it. When you look for the 10 largest craters on the Earth, they don't even list this. But it is. And what I found out about it is just incredible. It fits with the story of the flood. It fits with the story of what caused the break apart of the continents of, you know, that formed Pangaea. It fits what destroyed Atlantis. It fits in the flood what broke up the fountains of the deep and made hot water spurt up from underneath the Earth's layer there in the Moho discontinuity, which erupted into the oceans to fill them. It explains why all of this occurred. Now, that Kudapa crater, if you look at the second image, you'll see where the original North Pole was at that time before the meteor impacted, and you'll see the Atlantic Bulge, which I'll talk about in a minute, and the Kudapa crater. For yonks, people have looked at the mud map, the bathymetry of the Indian Ocean, and seen that ridge, that outline. It came down from just above Madagascar and curved all the way up into the Arabian Peninsula. A little fault line or ridge, it looked like, in the ocean bottom. And I looked at it too, and in 2014 I said, look, I used what I'm going to tell you, but I used all this to put the Earth back together and to see where the Garden of Eden was. And certainly it works well if you say, let's squeeze India down to where Madagascar is, stretch it down there and shove it into the coast of Africa, because there was a little seam in the seafloor which showed where they originally connected. That's fine. But there are two ways to look at this. I thought that the Chicxulub meteor on the other side of the planet had gone into the Earth, into the mantle, and bounced over and pushed up the sea there to form a rise that moved India away and moved Africa and Saudi Arabia to the west. But when you start looking at it, the depth of the Indian Ocean here does not support that. It's lower. And not only that, there's a gravitational map, which I've got on the show images page, which NASA made, showing that that area in between Saudi Arabia and India today, in that area there's a blue circle, particularly around the tip of India. It says there is a shortage of mass there. Gravity is much weaker there than any other place on the Earth. And I thought, well, that's a coincidence, because that's very close to where this Kudapa crater was. Suppose that this 300-mile diameter crater, the meteor that made that, went down into the Earth at a shallow angle and shoved ahead of it to the west matter, you know, mass, underneath the mantle. And in so doing, it shoved an increase of mass over toward the Atlantic Ocean. And I found it. I found it. And you can see that in the show images page there. If you look at the second row right image, this path of meteor to Atlantic Bulge, I found a 2.3 million square mile area that's raised up in the North Atlantic along the ridge in a direct line with where that meteor impacted Atlantic. India, and right through the Middle East and over into that area, increasing the mass not only in the Mid-Atlantic, but also in southern Europe, northern Africa, and surprise, surprise, in the top part of the Arabian Peninsula, while it dropped down the southern part. In other words, it tilted the whole Arabian Peninsula. This was the destruction that not only caused the flood, it destroyed Atlantis. And it sank it on the southern end and raised the mountains on the northern end there. And because of that, people have not been able to find the island of Atlantis. But when you shove that area back down at the top of the Arabian Peninsula and you lift it up in the Rub al-Khali in the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula, if you lift that up and put the other end down, the water levels flood, and I've done that, and it shows you where the original Atlantis coastline was. And that whole area of the Arabian Peninsula at that time, before the impact of that meteor, was an island. An island of 2.3 million square miles. Sorry, 1.3 square million miles. 1.3. And the reason I emphasize the area of it is a lot of people have been trying to make a case for the Atlantic Bulge, or, you know, that area there in the Atlantic, for that being the area of Atlantis. But it's 2.3 million square miles versus 1.3, which would be half of that. And if you zoom down into that on Google Earth and other places, there's just no mass in that Atlantic sea bottom that could support an island that's 1.3 million square miles. We're talking about a big place. Anyway, that was that. Now, there's a blow up of that on the second row first image. You can get in closer to the center of the bulge, and you can see kind of a star shaped or triangular, three arm spiral type thing is the high point of that ridge. But this is what caused that ridge. The impact of that crater in the Kutupa crater over in eastern India. Now, one of the things that's not immediately obvious, and I'll be discussing this in the lecture, I'm making animations to show it, is this. I missed it the first time I talked about the planetary expansion and separating Africa and India from an asteroid impacting the other side of the planet there. That didn't work. When I corrected that, I noticed something I hadn't paid attention to. The west side of India has a positive curve to it, like curving out to the left toward Africa and Arabia. Why does it have a positive curve when you look at the mud map down there in the ocean and it curves the other way? Something had to hit it and curl it to push the curve out. So I started looking and I found, after a bit of scratching my head and looking around, I did find that the Kutupa crater might be there where India is today, but it struck India down underneath the little tip where Sri Lanka is. It struck the ocean there, and it shoved its way underneath the mantle over into the Atlantic Ocean, but in the process it made a shockwave push Africa and Arabia and Europe to the northwest, and it also caused India to shrink up and push up into the Himalayas like I thought, but it really compacted India a lot because it hit on the east side. Anyway, if you look at that or get on the Google Earth, you can see what I'm talking about, and zoom down in, you'll see the most astonishing thing. I mean, it's real. I mean, we've just missed it all these years that there was an impact crater in the eastern side of India. And they're looking. The geologists around the planet are looking for a shallow impact crater that could have done what this one did. And what was that? Well, other than the flood and the destruction of Atlantis, it also tilted the Earth 23.5 degrees off of its normal spinning upright. And in that time, what happened was Iceland was our North Pole. And I put an arrow to it on the second image there, and you can see where that was the North Pole at that time. So all of the references made by Plato and Solon to the arrangement of things on the island of Atlantis are relative to Iceland being the North Pole. So the North was in that direction from the Middle East. And if you do the work, the mathematics of it, where that crater hit is turning the planet exactly 23.5 degrees off of that part where Iceland is, the North Pole then. It could have turned it to 23.5 degrees in a lot of other places, but it didn't. It did it so that our current North Pole was formed at the angle of impact where the Earth was spinning around, and then this crater impacted, and the net result of the vectors, you know, the force on it and the Earth's spin caused it to shift 23.5 degrees. And if you get into Google Earth and look at the top, at the North Pole in the sea there, you will see a long, zigzaggy, like fissure running through the North Pole, where it is now, and over toward Iceland. And that was where the two poles were. It forms a border between where Iceland was and where our current North Pole is. And you can see the link between the two North Poles at that time. And that fissure may have been formed by the impact as well. Isn't that incredible?
It's incredible that you're, folks, you're hearing it first live here on Hagman and Hagman. It's incredible research findings. Wow. Okay. Wow.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else on that that, yeah, that would be of use there. Let me see, we've got the aliens or the fallen ones. You know, another interesting thing I found a week or 2 weeks ago was that the Egyptians borrowed some of the names in the early Genesis account that were the sons of Adam and Eve. I think I mentioned this last show, where they said that Set, the Egyptian god Set, was this fair-skinned, red-headed guy who came out of the desert, you know, a wild man or a strong man or whatever. But in the Genesis account, Set or Seth is the son of Adam and Eve that replaced Abel. And he appears in the Egyptian lore. And there's Enos, another son on Adam and Eve's side, appears as, there's a variant of his name that appears in the Egyptian mythology of their little g gods. And I got to wondering, what do they mean in the ancient times when they call a person a god? It must be a person who has long life, superhuman abilities and powers, and therefore he qualifies as superhuman. So nowadays I tend to say, when a little g gods, I start to say superhumans rather than that, because there's basically one God and one Son of God, and that's, you know, our creator, the Elohim, and Jesus, the son of the Elohim and an earth woman. It's strange that the Atlantis legends talk about that too, for the island of Atlantis being populated by Poseidon, who took for wife a woman, or a woman named Cleito, and had five pairs of twins from her, and out of that came the descendants that colonized all of the Arabian Peninsula. You see the scenario repeated where a god, in this case a superhuman Poseidon, came and mated with an earth woman. We just see that thing addressed in Genesis 6, you know, about the Nephilim, and all kinds of things kind of add together when you look at this global picture. I'm just really starting to see a much bigger, more detailed, refined picture of our ancient past.
Just to be clear, I mean, your basic, all of your research and findings, if you put all of this together, it verifies the account of the Bible. It verifies things that, well, like this Kudapop crater, verifies what scientists have suspected but not been able to pinpoint, which you have,
right,
through your research. And just in case listeners, we have new listeners, Atlantis, 1.3 million square miles. Its location, suspected location, according to your research, is where?
Just to, the Arabian Peninsula. Yeah.
The Arabian, okay, all right. So all of this, and that was destroyed by the meteor strike, which caused the flood, which, here we are. Okay, I mean, it's so everything is tying together.
Yeah, scripture.
Sorry, go ahead. What?
And we were, Stan, we were talking about this off air before the segment began. Just so people don't get confused, the rain as well as the meteor is what caused the flood. And there's some, and going back through Genesis 7, reading the account, it talks about the ark and how the rain started, and it kept increasing and increasing. But at one point, it talks about the ark was raised from waters, onto the face of the waters. And it makes a distinction here, almost like it was above the earth. And I'm looking for the passage here in the scripture. But
I think the primary question Stan would address all of the water sources, basically.
Right. But the rain, though, I mean, and the way you said it, that made it sound like a meteor caused the flood completely when there was the rain started.
Wait. That's what I meant, too. The rain was a result of the impact.
Right.
It caused the condensation of probably that canopy of water we had over the earth since the time of the Garden of Eden. You know, I'm a canopy theorist. And that caused that to condense and fall as rain onto the earth's surface. But that was only for 40 days and nights.
Before the flood, the water came from the dew of the ground. Is that correct?
That's right. It rose up as a mist, and of course it was very humid on the surface of the earth, but everything was watered from that mist that came up.
Okay.
And what was the purpose of the water canopy? For those people who are not familiar with the canopy theory, or the canopy, I guess it could be a theory, what was the purpose of the water, and what would it look like? I guess a lot of people have trouble wrapping their minds around what that would look like.
Okay, well, you would probably be able to see stars much clearer because the water in the atmosphere and that canopy up there would magnify starlight. And so with the naked eye, you could see a lot more star formations than you can now, which might explain why some of the ancient African tribes like the Dogon, whatever, could see Sirius patterns with the naked eye that we would now use a telescope to see. And if you were out standing on the ground on the earth, it would be like... It would be like during a big rainstorm or just after a big rainstorm where the clouds are overhead and everything, but there's this kind of eerie light, a diffuse light with a slightly greenish-bluish color, very slight. And if you looked up, you could see at night the stars and you could see the sun coming through. It would have been a more diffuse sun. And the moon would look bigger, too. Because
that
of
makes
this
sense.
Lens effect.
Yeah.
I felt this once when I was a kid in a rainstorm. I was out in the front yard and this eerie green light and the storm was over, but it finished raining and there was this new, wet, fresh feeling all around me. And I often hearken back to that when I think about how it was like with the canopy over the earth in those days. And it's a really... unusual feeling. I'm not sure exactly how to explain it, but it would have been normal to the people back then. To us now, it would be a very peaceful and beautiful feeling in that kind of moist environment where everything is not dry. Anyway, that was before the flood, and the impact, that shock to the planet, kabang. Remember, the planet was smaller than it is now by about 25%. Because it enlarged from what it was by a third. That's mathematics for you, but anyway. It was smaller in diameter. And when this meteor impacted and started the continental drift, a massive continental drift, which took, you know, several hundred years for it to complete, I think, when that happened, it caused the Earth's rotation to slow, the surface of the Earth, and it started to expand. Normally planets expand as they get older, but this one is expanding while it's still young. It's got, you know, hot core, so it can stretch. And that expansion didn't occur until after the flood and, you know, the impact was completed. But the impact broke up an area there in the Indian Ocean, if not from there all the way across the Atlantic Ocean. It broke up a subterranean shell of water, and it's called the Moho discontinuity by scientists. I think they discovered that in 1958. And it's a waterish, like a water shell, at least one shell like that that's full of salty water. It's 3.3 times the saltiness or density of seawater, or fresh water, sorry. So that was broken up, and the volume of water in that, plus what we had in the oceans, is enough to cover high mountains. So how far it went, I'm not sure, but I would say that there was plenty of water there, certainly in the half of the globe over in the Middle East there, to cover the mountains, or the smaller mountains, you know, 8, 9, 10,000 feet. That would be what the Genesis account talks about is the high mountains were covered with water. We can see seashells and stuff on top of those mountains over in that area.
In Genesis 7:10-12, it says this, and it came to pass after 7 days that the waters of the flood were upon the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, in the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. And the rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights.
Yeah, and that's when the meteor impacted to cause the rains to fall from the heavens.
I mean,
I could
just picture water coming from everywhere because of the meteor strike. You know, bang, you got geysers, gushers, water coming from above, below. You know, you got chaos and pretty rough on real estate values back then when that hit.
Yeah. Somewhere in that Genesis account, maybe in Genesis 7, it tells about that the water stayed upon the earth for 150 days, I think, before, you know. But there's also a place in there about the 100 and maybe it was 40 plus 110. That's what it was. That the water kept coming in after the rain stopped, after the 40 days and nights, the water kept coming up from the fountains of the deep for another 110 days, which would have meant 150 days total that the waters prevailed over the surface of the earth. I think that's how we figured that. It's been a while since I did the sums on that. My whole objective in this research on Eden and Atlantis and, you know, the flood and stuff is to prove the authenticity of Genesis, you know, the Bible, the basis of the Bible, to give scientific credence to an area that, you know, a lot of people who are not believers at all would not trust because it doesn't agree with modern science. And one of the biggest differences that prevents people from accepting this is the length of time the Earth has been in existence, the length of time the universe has been in existence, and the way we determine that is very flimsy indeed. It's using the decay rate of radioactive materials to determine the age of a fossil, of a landform, you know, or artifacts or whatever. And based upon the current rate of decay of radioactive materials, scientists extrapolate back billions of years to the origin of the universe and whatever, saying that if it is a constant, then this is how long the universe has been in existence. But what these physicists, these astronomers, and everyone else is trying to determine the age of the Earth, and hence, you know, the timeline for humanity, what they've all overlooked is that in Einstein's theory and subsequent theories that are now forming, the universe was all condensed into a single, very super dense mass, which exploded. And that was the Big Bang. Now, at that moment, the density of space and the matter in it was so, so huge that waves in it, electromagnetic waves, you know, like light and radioactive particles of emission, waves in it traveled maybe 3 million times faster than they do now. So when you plot a graph from the Big Bang, it forms a kind of a curve that sharply flattens out toward where we are now. And that period of 13 billion years is suddenly reduced to less than 50,000 for the entire universe. Now, until we can get scientific community to agree to accept what's called the time variant curve from the Big Bang till now, until they can accept that, they will not be able to agree with our timing on the flood and on the Atlantis and on the age of the Earth and various strata and, you know, artifacts that we find on the Earth. That's the big difference. And if you look at the Earth and the universe being that young, then you better start feeling very panicky about your relationship with whoever created it, because time's going to be called here shortly. We're running out. The universe is now in entropy so much that it's reaching the point where things will start to dissolve and break up.
Entropy.
Well, running down. It's the energy of spins.
Yeah. I mean, it's the... natural process of things. Man, that's a lot to dump on. Wow. It's my go-to word.
You know me. Hey, listen, it looks like Trump and Hillary both lost Wisconsin tonight in the primary stuff up there.
Cruz and Sanders.
I had an article. Say again?
Yeah. Cruz and Sanders look to have taken Wisconsin, and Larry M. from Santa Clarita saying, you know, hey, there's a lot of voter fraud taking place in real time, according to Politico. Basically, everything's being manipulated. But Cruz and Sanders, the two winners of Wisconsin, apparently, at this moment. Go ahead, sir.
Well, I was just looking at an article also on the news that came out earlier today. Is Trump decided to explain how he was going to pay for that wall between United States and Mexico, how he was going to make Mexico pay for it, because that's always been kind of a question mark. You get up and wave his hands and get red in the face and say, I'm going to make him do it. And, of course, the president of Mexico said, I'm not going to pay for that freaking wall. And anyway, it got very ugly. And so I looked to see how Trump was going to pay for the wall, how he proposed to do it. And basically, he's going to stop payments from stop payments from immigrants in the United States, Mexican immigrants, stop payment from here to the relatives back in Mexico, unless Mexico agrees to pay for the wall. Now, here, there are a couple big problems with that statement, if that's what he plans to do. One, he didn't say how he was going to determine which immigrants he was going to target, because there are some legal immigrants which are okay. The illegal immigrants, if he targeted them, certainly you can find the banks and bank accounts of people that aren't registered, you know, in Social Security and whatever, and say, well, those are illegal residents. But how do you stop them from, the illegal residents from, or immigrants, from going over to legal immigrants that they know and saying, look, here's $500 I need to send to my Aunt Mary down in Mexico City. Can you put it through your account? You wouldn't know. They would find an alternate route to send the money down. And even if he does go ahead and impact the legal immigrants by saying, well, we're not letting you send money to Mexico for a while, you're talking about $100 billion worth of transfer down into Mexico. If you stop that, certainly the Mexican economy would suffer for it, as would our legal immigrants up here. But in the Mexican economy, they're going to you know, scream that we don't have enough money, sales are down, we're not getting support from our relatives in the States. And this is going to make Mexico turn around and find, you know, $50 to $60 billion to build the wall. They are so close to falling over at the moment, Mexico is, you know, financially, that without this money flowing in from their illegal and legal immigrants here, the Mexican economy would fail overnight. So how are they going to find the money they need to fund the wall to appease Trump's proposal, you know, if they're already broke and have no ways to get to it? That doesn't make sense. So I can see that there's a lot of problems with what he's suggesting. And just in the implementation, I mean, on the surface, it's a great idea, but in the implementation, there are a lot of holes and loopholes that the illegals and the Mexican government can use that would deny that. So I'm afraid that that proposal by Trump is just not well thought out. And I support Trump, by the way, but I just think that's not a clever thought.
Interesting. And, okay. What you said makes sense. People need to do research, I think. People really need to understand certain things. I mean, just because someone says it can be done doesn't mean it can be done. Or it could be done in the way people say, in this case, what Trump says. So this is very interesting. Stan, I got some questions. We have some questions from the listeners that go back to various topics. If you don't mind, if we can just digress a bit.
Okay.
What about the Giants after the flood? This comes from Nancy D. I'm not exactly sure what...
How did the Giants occur after the flood?
Okay, yes.
I think that's what you're saying. Well, that was the riddle that crosses the rabbi's eyes. It's hard to know exactly unless you accept the fact that the flood was a regional flood and it didn't kill the whole planet. It killed most of the hybrid beings on the Arabian Peninsula, which was Atlantis. That's what God was after, was the strange flesh, you know, the crossbred hybrids between fallen angels and humans. But it would appear that there were sporadic little pockets of survivors. And I've also wondered about India and that survivor thing where I don't remember many giants over there, but there's a lot of details in the ancient writings of India about wars between the sky gods and stuff. And I've often wondered, why did sons of Noah or their descendants go over after the flood into India, which was the land of Nod? You know, it was known as the land of Nod, which is the land of the men wandering as fugitives, which is Cain and his descendants. Why did they go there, settle, and put the red bindi mark in their forehead, which is the blood mark that was, you know, represented what was on Cain's head, so that people would not kill him, lest they have sevenfold the curses on them? You know, did some of them survive? Did you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I know there are people out there in the Christian community going to hang me for saying that, but I can't help but ask the question. That's what I'm doing. How else can we explain it?
Well, and to those people, look, we're having an intellectual discussion, folks. Don't go ballistic.
Yeah, please.
You know, I mean, really, we're having an intellectual discussion about non-salvation issues here, and we're allowed to ask questions, and I just don't want, because a lot of times people will overreact and say, well, that's not based in Scripture. Well, wait a second. In fact, let me address one of those here right now. Let me see if I can find it. Okay, when you were talking about the crater, Chris B. writes this. Well, there's two paragraphs here. I'm going to read the second first, which is really just a sentence. To say that others survived the flood beside what the scriptures say is flat out wrong. How do you respond to that?
Well, I can only say that as a scholar and a Christian believer, I am looking at the evidence that does not seem to fit with prophecy and trying to figure out with the history of the planet in the Bible and trying to fit that into what could have happened. And because we rely on the King James English translation of the Bible and New American and various others, they do not address the issue of what Ha'eretz meant. It was the region, and the physical evidence supports a huge flood in the region, destroying an entire island continent, which later, you know, the water drained off of, and it was again on the surface. But, you know, believe me, it makes me blink and wonder whether I'm wrong when I say, okay, how do we explain the giants after the flood, if not surviving? And the only other way I could see it would be as if they were, the fallen ones came again. And the Genesis account does say, and the Nephilim were in the earth in those days and after. So the Nephilim were before and after the flood, they were there. So how did they come again, or did they survive the flood? So that's the only thing I'm asking. I'm asking questions about this because I myself find it hard to reconcile the two, and I try to be a fair scientist evaluating data on both sides to try to find the truth. And that's all. I'm certainly not trying to...
No, and that's why I like discussions like this, because we can look at the data, we can look at the scripture, we can talk about this, and again, it's a discussion at an intellectual level. And I can tell you this: my faith is strong enough where I'm not. My faith is not shaken, you know. So anyway, now the same author, Crispy, writes this. The crater that you reference, as well as others, or as well as the other one mentioned, are not, and he insists, are not impact craters, but formations left over from the creation itself. These are scars from enormous plasma discharges, the power God used to make the earth as well as other bodies. I'm not exactly sure what that means.
No, and I don't think I agree with that either. But
he's
got a different model, and he's relating to that, you know, for creation and stuff. But okay. I never heard that the power God, you know, made plasma discharges in the earth. That's not in the scripture. I'm only going
okay.
What's in the scripture.
What's in the scripture?
Anyway,
right.
Here's another thing. Atlantis wasn't mentioned in the Genesis account, was it?
No.
Yet
no.
The fallen ones were, and you know the impure bloodline were mentioned. You know, there's a whole section between the Garden of Eden and the flood that's missing.
Do the non-canonical books address Atlantis at all?
Good question, and I don't think I saw references to it directly as such. No, I don't think I did, but I haven't read all of them. Certainly I've read parts of Enoch and Jubilees and things like that, and the Book of Adam, and Book of Adam's a bit sus. But anyway, even Enoch has a lot of textual, like factual, historical, and geophysical errors in the writing. So I don't trust the Book of Enoch entirely, but it does talk about, you know, the watchers being in the earth and that kind of thing, and which is more detailed about the fallen ones than we get in Genesis account. Have you ever noticed, let's see how much time we got, have you ever noticed that when God appears to man, you know, whether it be to Moses or, you know, to the ascension of Jesus on the mount or various things, that it's up on a high mountain. He appears to Moses on Jabal al-Laws in southwest Saudi Arabia. He appears on the mountain there and doesn't let Moses look at him directly because his presence would destroy Moses. So he lets Moses hide in the cleft of the mountain. And if you look at the Jabal al-Laws in Google Earth, it's a very like fractured mountaintop with a cavern of igneous rock and stuff that split and made places a cliff that you can hide in, not just a gentle mountain. It's ragged and jagged, and you can hide in there. Anyway, that was a high place. Now, the 200 angels that are reputed to have come to earth in the Bible and some of the extra canonical books says that 200 angels ascended onto Mount Hermon, and that's a high mountain in the northern part of the Glen Heights, you know, in Syria there. They came to a high mountain to descend, a very high mountain. Okay, and it's a high mountain again. Nimrod goes to build the Tower of Babel, and in the Genesis account it says, let us, the Elohim plural, let us go down and confound their language and destroy the tower that Nimrod is building so they can't reach up here to become as one of us. Now, he was building a tall tower, so it's like not a mountain, but it's a man-made kind of pyramidal-type structure, a ziggurat. Why were they afraid that at the top of that thing he could access where they were? Now, this is after the flood, and so as it was with Moses, and so why would that be a threat? So apparently there's a way to hit the gateway up off the surface of the earth somewhere, you know, technically some way to do it, to enter from our world into the Creator's world, into God's world, into the parallel kingdoms, parallel universes.
Okay. Yeah, that's a great question. Dr. Michael Lake, in his book,
The Shinar Directive,
says that the makes mention, it basically addresses that question, asks that same question, but also mentions that the tower itself was built on a plain as opposed to like a mountaintop. And there's a question as to why. Could it be a location issue? You know, as opposed to a height issue.
And I think of CERN, you know, could it be a technological or, you know, some type of advanced technology or abilities that we don't have today that were back then?
But you make a good point.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, look, there are many things that we're discovering now which are the result of an increase in knowledge and the going to and fro, as the prophecies forecast. Without the internet and the sharing of information between cultures and languages and stuff, we would not be able to understand the depth and the detail of ancient history until now, when we're old enough to accept it. We've listened to the stories from the Bible and parroted them, and that's been enough. But now, to have to answer the arguments of the scientists of the world, we're being forced to dig into the word in great depth and being able to alter our perception in what we thought was the scripture saying. Anyway, there are a number of issues that are of great interest in the Bible when you start to go in and look at the words, how they were translated, what the alternate meanings were, and apply them to what's happening today. In Daniel, when he's talking about King Nebuchadnezzar's dream of a statue, the statue's toes, 10 toes, were mixed clay and iron, and they did not mix with the seed of man. This is talking about superhumans, you know, mixing, mating with humans there in Daniel's dream in the last kingdom, which is where we are now. We're approaching the 10 kingdoms.
And it says they would not cleave. Stan, we've reached the very end of the show. Thank you so much again for the gift of your time. Tell Holly we said hello, and until next week, stay safe and God bless.
God.
That will do it for us. tomorrow.
This is the Global Star Radio Network.
The Genesis.